TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Genetic Engineering of Human Beings. The Discovery of the Human Genome and the Cloning of Babies. The Human Genome Project began in 1990. Researchers were expecting to find about 150,000 genes that make up a human being. They were expecting to unlock the secrets of the special status of human beings and the reasons for disease or special traits. 10 years later, the results were published. The huge ceremony in the White House Rose Garden clouded the fact that researchers found not 150,000, but only around 30,000 genes. They discovered that the sequence of the human genome can also be found in flies, worms, and our pet dogs. Rather than being humbled by that discovery, genetic engineering continues in plants and animals and is now extended into humans. The cloning of babies is openly discussed, and we are all called upon to make an ethical decision whether we will allow this to happen. The first speaker is Paul Billings. Paul Billings is a physician and scientist with a PhD in immunogenetics. He's also a medical geneticist and director for the past 10 years of the Council for Responsible Genetics. He begins by calling into question some of the findings of the Human Genome Project. Paul Billings.
There is no sequence of the human genome. There is a draft sequence. It is a very rough draft. There are areas where the error rate is on the order of 30%. There already have been instances where the human genome sequence has been found in the fly genome sequence. So there is a long way to go before the sequence of a human being will be available in any form that will be of any use, either for people who are interested in developing therapeutics or people interested in developing diagnostic tests, which will be of any use to anybody. Second of all, one of the good things that has come out of even the sort of preliminary analysis of the human genome is that the human genome is not a blueprint for making a human being, that it did not sustain this kind of industrial model for thinking about humans, because in fact, whether you think there are 30 or 40,000 or maybe even 100,000 genes in the human genome, and there's still a lot of dispute about the exact number, the number of proteins that are produced by the human genome is probably on the order of 5 to 10 times more than the number of genes. And the proteins are where the action is in terms of development and control of biological processes. So the genome sequence is not and never will be a blueprint for producing humans. The third thing that came out of the genome sequence was that our genomes, no matter how many genes, are not particularly different from worms or mice or dogs or anything else. And so whatever special qualities you think you have and which distinguish you from your pet or farm animals or plants, for that matter, they're not likely to be on the basis of at least the number of genes that you have. And since we share most of our genes with the rest of the animal kingdom, not likely to be on the basis of your genes. The fourth point that came out of the sequencing of the human genome was that we are all, everyone in this room, shares about 99.9% of your genes. You're absolutely identical at about 99.9% of the genetic sites in your genome. So that, I think, provides at least some biological basis for we're all in this boat together. And then finally, the genome sequence, interestingly, is not a stable thing. The genome is a dynamic, responsive to the environment organ where genes are changing and jumping around and exchanging with other genetic sites within your genome all the time. So even if we thought that we had a refined sequence of the human genome, that would only be true at a particular point in time and that the changes occur within the genome in response to the environment at all times. Okay. Those are my comments about the human genome. My second large point is that the development of biotechnology and the growth of funding for biotechnology over the last 20 years, again, primarily in the United States, has used essentially two tools to garner both public and political support. One was that it would relieve the suffering of disease and illness and promote health. And the second is that science, research and development, is a fundamentally a hopeful and creative human activity, and so should be promoted, supported, and be unfettered. And in fact, in this country, before 1980, the vast majority of investment in research and development, particularly in the health sector, was done by the government and thus by the taxpayers. So what have we really gotten from that investment? Well, we haven't, and everyone would agree, had much of a yield in terms of effective pharmaceuticals. What we have seen is an extension of technologies into research designs. That is, we've developed technologies which can powerfully alter biological systems, but those have not yet yielded and may never yield useful therapeutics. We have developed a commercialization of a variety of health processes and a marketplace in the healthcare market, but the positive health results of that, except for, I would say, a more informed patient group, and that's primarily through the internet, and for people who have access to the internet, we haven't really seen anything but more commercialization of healthcare issues. And I think what we're going to hear from a couple of the from our, the other two speakers on the panel are examples where the powerful interests of industry in biotechnology are turning what were issues of human suffering or issues of progress in science into a more manufacturing, more widget kind of ideology. My final point is that as genetic technology and genetic engineering progress, some of the older problems associated with genetics and human society are once again rearing their heads. These were common in the 30s and 20s in this country and in Western Europe and were associated with the eugenics movement, which was very popular in the United States. And by that I mean genetic discrimination issues, the creation of groups which are defined in part by their genes and then are stigmatized, the creation of classes of people who are uninsurable or unemployable. Genetic technology is clearly producing them once again, and we do not yet have an infrastructure in place to prevent the recurrence of these kinds of problems that have plagued us really throughout the 20th century. I'm going to stop there. Let me introduce the next speaker, who's a colleague of mine. Marcy Darnofsky has a PhD from UC Santa Cruz and teaches at Sonoma State. I work with her at the Exploratory Initiative, which is interested in tracking new genetic technologies and creating an infrastructure which hopefully will control them and limit them appropriately. Marcy.
Thanks, Paul. And I'm going to pick up where Paul left off. It's going to be seamless, because what got me into this area was finding out that there's new twist on eugenics that's coming down the road very, very quickly. And we sometimes call it techno-eugenics. And I'm talking here about the technology that would make possible, if it were developed, the production of human clones and what the media often calls designer babies. And what they mean by that is being able to directly manipulate the genes that we pass on to our children. There is a very aggressive campaign going on right now by a disturbingly large number of very influential scientists, bioethicists, biotech entrepreneurs, and others who think that developing these technologies to produce human clones and designer babies is a very positive thing. They think that they're on a mission. Human cloning is on the near horizon if we don't do our work and prevent it from happening. We started hearing from a group of fertility doctors who do have experience in the human physiology of reproduction. They are IVF clinic operators. One is an Italian, the other one is an American. He was working at the University of Kentucky. And they announced that they were going to begin right away efforts to clone a human child. They were going to do this for the purposes of relieving infertility. When that news broke, we started to get human cloning in the headlines and on the front pages of the news magazines. These ideas of producing human clones and enhanced children and alpha humans is becoming almost a normalized sense of part of our sensibility. We're seeing children's literature. I've got some of it here. There's a series of preteen novels about this 12-year-old who's cloned. There's a television show, Dark Angel, some of you may have seen it, about a genetically enhanced young woman. The enhanced people, heroes of the books and the movies and the television shows, can see farther, hear better, they're stronger, they run faster, they're smarter, and they're presented as these very attractive people. And so we're getting a generation of children who are being raised thinking that, you know, hey, maybe this isn't such a bad thing. These were things that were shocking to me that I heard just in the last month. One was about an 8-year-old who asked his mom if they could take a clipping of her hair so that in case anything happened to her, she could be cloned. This stuff is being presented as attractive and also as inevitable. And that's the mantra that we hear about all the biotechnological procedures. It's inevitable. And I think that, you know, whether it's intended to be demoralizing to the opponents and critics or not, that is probably its effect, and we have to be on guard against that. Well, let me talk a little bit about cloning. Why would anyone want to clone a child? The two most convincing reasons that are given are for infertility purposes. But the fact of the matter is that there are extraordinarily few couples in the world that both members of which cannot produce gametes, and those would be the only people who could not be assisted to have a biologically related child with other assisted reproduction technologies. The other argument that's presented often as a reason to go ahead and clone children is this thing that the Raelians are going to do. Well, my child died, and I want to clone the child to replace the child. When I heard this, I found this to be not an argument for cloning, but one of the strong arguments against cloning. I think that when you think that you can replace a loved one by reproducing that person's genes, that you're really confusing what a person is, and you're really assaulting the dignity of human relationships, and by thinking that you could replace someone by, I mean, it reduces people to replaceable parts. So I don't think these arguments are terribly compelling for cloning. But even if you were to say, well, maybe so, maybe a little, maybe this, there's a lot of arguments against human cloning. And I want to quickly tell you what I think the key ones are. The first one actually is something that everyone, including the advocates of human cloning, acknowledge. And that is that the risk to both the cloned child and to the woman who carries the clone are huge. In animals, what they're seeing is much more often than not, even those animals that make it to birth, which is a small percentage, less than a percent, are either born with or develop serious anomalies, and it's often lethal. And the much celebrated cloned cow named Millie for Millennium died suddenly in the field a few weeks ago, and they haven't said that they know why. So the safe and healthy risks that right now are enormous, but we can't necessarily expect that they won't work out those technical glitches. And I don't think we can rely on that argument, really, finally, as an argument against human cloning. But I think the other arguments are very, very compelling. And I sort of arbitrarily give you four reasons for thinking about what's wrong with human cloning. The first one is that a cloned child would always live in the shadow of the genetic donor, the nuclear donor. And whether or not that would be a misguided expectation that such a child would be just like the person from whom she or he was cloned. But I think that those expectations on the part of the parents might be inescapable. and I think it would exacerbate that problem that we already see. The second related problem with human cloning is that it really objectifies and commodifies children. It makes them into manufactured objects, commodified objects that are kind of replaceable. A clone, just like, you know, you make another one just like the other one. The third reason is that it constitutes a kind of control over the physical identity of another person that I believe borders on the despotic or the abusive. And I don't think that we should allow people to be able to genetically design other people. That should be outside the borders, in my opinion. And the fourth reason, the last reason, though, is the one that actually is the most compelling to me. And this gets back to this new twist on eugenics, the techno-eugenics. And that is that both technically and symbolically and culturally, human cloning is a companion technology to the technology that would allow us to manipulate the genes we pass on to our children, the production of designer babies. Now, the vision of the people who think that this is the way to go is that in the near future, we will have couples who can afford it visiting their local fertility clinics and literally selecting their children's traits from a catalog. And they believe that this is just like giving your child piano lessons or Spanish lessons or something, that it's like this program of improvement for your children, and that parents not only will want it, but they will feel obligated to do this for the best interests of their offspring. They also have a much more grandiose kind of discourse about seizing control of human evolution. And many of them are absolutely explicit about this. You don't have to read between the lines. They see this as a eugenic agenda. They see that once we go down this road, that we will be heading towards the emergence of genetic castes. They say that there will be, in the words of one of these advocates, the gen rich, who control government, media, business, and that'll be 10% of the American population. And the other 90%, who he calls the naturals, who he says will work as laborers and sweep the floors. Now, I am not paraphrasing here. This is this guy, Lee Silver, from Princeton University. And many of his colleagues in this campaign, which amounts to really a marketing campaign to promote these technologies and make them acceptable to the American people, in their words, they're, you know, credentialed. They work for prestigious institutions. They are reputable. And that's what I found so frightening when I first learned that this campaign was going on. Well, I want to take a step back now and tell you that because I am so strongly opposed to this kind of application of human genetic engineering, it doesn't mean that I think it's just like all biotechnology or all other human genetic technologies. I think that there are some really important lines that we need to keep in mind. And here's the one thing that I think, if you do remember this and walk away knowing this distinction, you'll be able to interpret what you read in the newspapers a lot more easily. And it's the distinction between the kind of genetic engineering that is aimed at helping people who have some kind of condition. It's aimed at alleviating their symptoms and, you know, helping them live better lives. And that is the kind of genetic engineering that's going on now in human beings, in clinical trials across the country. Those kinds of technologies need to be evaluated in just the ways that Paul was talking about. Are they safe? Are they effective? Is this the best use of our medical resources, of the money, of the talent? And those are really, really important questions. But that kind of genetic engineering, the so-called gene therapy, which has not been shown to be safe, effective, and is not necessarily the best use of our medical resources, that's on one side of a line. On another side of the line is manipulating the genes we pass on to our children, and that technically is called germline engineering, and it's called germline because it affects the germ cells, the sperm and the egg. And that technology, we think, needs to just be banned. There needs to be laws against it. And we're fortunate that there's a pretty bright line that can separate that and that can allow us to say this is a policy that we need to put in place. And in fact, bans on those kinds of applications, these two applications, the one, germline and genetic engineering, and the other, human cloning, already exist in over 36 countries in the world. In some countries, Japan is one example, if you try to clone a human being, it's a felony. You go to jail for 10 years. You pay a huge fine. What we do need are global bans on human cloning and on human germline engineering, and we need effective regulations of other new human genetic and reproductive technologies. These things need to be brought under responsible societal governance. This is one of the most consequential technological thresholds that humanity has ever faced. And we have a window of opportunity right now to say no, to say we're going to foreclose that, to say, yeah, we are going to put regulations on what biotechnology companies and on what scientists can do, because we don't want to go down the road to this post-human techno-eugenic future. And, you know, I think there's just a common sense way of thinking about this, that if we want to improve the lives of our children, we really have straightforward ways to do that, ways that we know about. We can give prenatal care to women who are pregnant. We can give kids health care and education. We can set up society so that adults have time to spend with children. Improving the lives of our children has really nothing to do with manipulating their genes. And I think people will understand this when we bring them this message.
Thank you, Marcy. The last speaker is Andrew Imparato. Andrew is a graduate of Yale and Stanford Law School, has worked with some of the leading policy people in the disability movement and in disability issues over the years, and is now president and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities, a Washington-based organization. Andrew.
My basic message tonight comes from the Americans with Disabilities Act, which says that disability is a natural part of the human experience, that in no way should limit a person's ability to make choices, pursue meaningful careers, live with dignity and self-determination, and participate fully in all aspects of society. That's the bedrock principle of disability rights, that disability is a natural part of the human experience that should in no way limit you. That's a revolutionary principle. We have a long way to go as a society before we achieve that, but that's the goal, and it's laid out with strong bipartisan support in a statute that passed in 1990 and was signed by a Republican president. What I'm going to do tonight in my brief time is to take that principle and apply it to the field of human genetic engineering. And really, there's two main points that come up when you apply the principle for me. The first is that we are not ready as a disability rights community to support any kind of human genetic engineering until there is much more widespread acceptance of that principle, that disability is a natural part of human experience, and that people with disabilities themselves make the choices for themselves. Until we are convinced that American society gets that, we will fight human genetic engineering in any form. The second piece that I wanted to get across is that, assuming that we do have the public acceptance of the fact that disability is a natural part of human experience and shouldn't limit people's choices and their ability to participate fully, we're still going to need real safeguards with teeth against things like discrimination, coercion, privacy violations, and punishing people for not complying with genetic prescriptions. I believe that the genetic information that we have today is making it easier for insurers, employers, governments, and individuals to exclude, eliminate, devalue, and demean people with genetic-linked impairments and disabilities, including folks who have a genetic marker but no symptoms of the indicated condition. And that's, I guess, my biggest point for you all, is that human genetic engineering poses a real threat to the autonomy, economic, and physical well-being and security of all of us, because we all have genes that might be interpreted by someone as an anomaly or a defect that we probably don't know about. And we don't know where this science is taking us, but to think that it's only going to affect people like me that know about our disabilities, to me it's naive. This is something that affects all of us. We don't know where it's going to end. And I wanted to touch on some real-world examples of attitudes that can lead to a massive, harmful disability discrimination and ultimately extermination of people with disabilities, which are facilitated by quote-unquote advances in science and deep-seated fears, myths, and stereotypes and hatred against people with disabilities. One example from 1927 was a Supreme Court decision called Buck versus Bell. And I'm going to start with 1927, but a lot of my examples are in the last few years, so I don't think this is as far away from our current reality as some might imagine. This was written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was considered a brilliant Supreme Court justice. Carrie Buck, in the case, argued that state-imposed sterilization of people who were quote-unquote feeble-minded was unconstitutional. The court disagreed, siding with the quote-unquote experts, who alleged that people with disabilities, namely those collectively classified as feeble-minded, which included people with mental retardation, people with mental illness, and people with epilepsy, that these folks were a, quote, menace to society, threatened society's, quote, best citizens, unquote, and tended to, quote, sap the strength of the state. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, writing for the majority, ruled that it was, quote, this is a direct quote from a Supreme Court decision in 1927, better for the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. That was the highest court in the land in 1927. I'm going to fast forward past World War II and the Holocaust. I hope many of you know that the first victims of the Holocaust in Nazi Germany were people with disabilities. And if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you'll see examples of that and documentation of it. The head of the Ethics Department at Princeton has argued in writing that adults should be able to kill a child with a disability up to 28 days after birth. So this stuff is part of modern discourse. I'll stop there.
That was Andrew Imparato. He's a graduate of Stanford and Yale Law Schools and president of the American Association of People with Disabilities. You heard a program on genetic engineering of human beings recorded at a conference on the risks of biotechnology in San Diego in the summer of 2001. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on genetic engineering of human beings on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get a copy of the program on genetic engineering of human beings by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.